This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, I talk about A Little Life with Man Booker shortlisted novelist Hanya Yanagihara, and then journalist Anthony Lowenstein on his book Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. Hanya, thanks for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Neil.
This book, it's been described in many places as starting out as one thing and then perhaps surprisingly developing into something else. So I'll ask you to describe to me how you describe the book.
I describe it fundamentally as two things, a book about male friendship and also a book about a character who never gets better, about the impossibility of getting better once you've suffered certain trauma. And I think the sometimes oppressiveness of happiness and the oppressiveness of hope. But you're right, it begins as something quite different. It's kind of, there's a sort of sleight of hand quality to the book. It begins with the reader thinking it is one of my favorite literary subgenres, you know, the post-collegiate book in which everyone moves to New York and has sort of, you know, various hijinks there. And so the reader begins thinking it's that kind of story. And then the book gets darker kind of at the beginning of the first section and continues to slowly get darker as the book proceeds.
And so let's talk about that sort of beginning of the book in terms of it being the sort of post-college. Four friends finish college, they meet at college, they go to New York.
Right.
Let's talk about those four characters. Who are they?
So the four characters are JB, who's an artist, and Willem, who's an aspiring actor, and Malcolm, who's an architect, and Jude, who's a lawyer. And, you know, there's a kind of tidiness to having a group of four. It's, you know, it's kind of something that we know about from books and also from pop culture. And I do think that there is a sort of built-in surprise and suspensefulness whenever you have a group of friends and sort of watching what's going to happen to them over the course of their lives. And I would hope that for the reader, what happens to these characters is not completely what they might expect.
So JB, I mean, he's an artist. He works for briefly for a magazine while he's waiting to break into the art world. You work for New York Magazine yourself. So let's talk about perhaps how much of that sort of sketch of that New York life is taken from life.
You know, it's funny. I mean, even with the cover of the UK edition, the publisher really decided to focus on the New York quality of the book. And to me, it's not... I understand why people think it's a New York book, and it is a New York book, but it's not a New York book because of the institutions of New York or the events of New York. It's a book about New York because of the qualities of people who come to New York. And, you know, it's about, JB at one point talks about, or Willem at one point talks about how everyone who comes to New York has a sense of ambition. Now, that is completely true, and perhaps unique among cities, I think, where people are actively going there because they are dreaming of remaking themselves into something else. And also, I think they're in search of families. They're in search of either creating their own literal family or they're in search of becoming part of a tribe, which is one of the, you know, one of the things that really makes New York kind of hum with energy. So to me, I brought to bear not so much literal experiences, although many of those sorts of minor characters who populate this book are people who I've encountered. But I think the sort of what I brought to it more and what I think of when I think of New York is everyone's sense of shared bravado, their sense of self-reinvention, their sense of utter confidence, and also, you know, deep embarrassment. The sense of you have people who share a certain kind of entitlement, but not necessarily monetarily, but the sense that the world owes them something and they're going to go out and get it. And that, I think, is really when people talk about New York's energy and they talk about New York's fizz and crackle, I think that's what they're talking about. The sense that you have a huge number of people in a relatively small amount of physical space and everyone is certain that they're going to be the one who makes it.
And what is it about male friendship then that you wanted to talk about?
Well, you know, I think that male friendship and men in general are still quite limited in a lot of sense, socially and societally, by what they're allowed to do and what they're allowed to express. You know, when you have a female friendship, you're allowed to sort of express anything. You're allowed, there's no real strict boundaries in terms of physical affection. Female friendships are much more fluid in terms of how easily they can move into something else that's romantic, say. And they're much more charged in a lot of sense. Whereas with male friendship, there is a sense of propriety that I think is still observed. There's a sense of boundaries. There's a sense that you can't discuss certain things, or you can't say certain things. And, you know, as a novelist, it's a wonderful gift to have a group of people who really are hemmed in by cultural expectations of what they are and are not allowed to feel and say. And so, you know, when I went to an all-women's college, mm-hmm. and so I sort of missed those years when boys were actually becoming men. And when I got out of college, I went into a very female-dominated industry, which was book publishing. Mm-hmm. And so it was always interesting to me to watch how men, even the most sort of rebellious young men, in a sense, became men who had to abide by certain rules.
And that idea of men, you know, having certain ways in which they're not able to express themselves is going to come out more as we talk about where the book goes later on. When we're first reading this book and it looks like it might be this story of, you know, four young men making their way in New York, there's almost a sense in which it's almost sort of parodying that type of book, because what then will later on develop as the book turns into what it is, it's everything is exaggerated. Everything is sort of heightened a bit. All four of the boys are, I mean, almost absurdly successful.
Right.
They've all got, like, amazing careers and success. And then, as I said, when the book sort of developed into what it will, which we'll get to, the characters, like, you know, all the people that are around Jude are, everybody's really nice. Like,
right.
Everybody's really nice and helpful.
Right.
So let's talk about what that is. It's like a sort of deliberate, I've seen you describe it elsewhere as like a fairy tale quality, and that's where
yes.
it's going, isn't it?
Yes, and it is very much, you know, I wanted to take two very different literary genres, you know, the fairy tale and then the contemporary naturalistic novel, and marry them. And they're, you know, they're sort of an uneven, it's sort of an uneven marriage, but mm-hmm. I hope from that uneven marriage comes some of the sparks of the book. But it does hew to many of the conventions of a fairy tale. You know, I mean, there's very few parents in the book. There's an orphan. There's a child who's had to endure extreme deprivations and tortures. There's no mothers in the book. There's no time named in the book. The resolution, the sense of happiness or closure that mm-hmm. the book has is somewhat, I think, tinny in a sense, you know. And so I wanted to take those sorts of tropes and wed it to, as I said, the way that people speak these days, the kinds of jobs they might have, the way they think politically and socially, mm-hmm. The way that they demand things from life, and to see what would happen if you put those two together. But you're right. I mean, a lot of things in this book are very heightened and very extreme. It's not a subtle book by any means, and I don't think anyone's accused of being subtle. But yes, and everything is heightened in it. The horror is heightened, the love is heightened, everything is turned up a little too high. And I wanted to really do that deliberately to make it a book that didn't really fit squarely within the contemporary, I think, literary trends. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, the word that I've been using recently is cool, and I think a lot of fiction that's being written these days is cool. It's a little remote, it's a little sort of self-aware of not being too involved, mm-hmm. and this book is not that way. It's a book that is unapologetic about demanding the reader's attention, I think, and emotional involvement.
And you just mentioned there that it's, I mean, the book takes place over decades, but it's set in what is clearly obviously the modern age. You know, they have mobile phones, they send emails.
Right.
But they're not affected by outside sort of historical effects. It's timeless, and there's not really cultural references to pin it down to anything. All of, you know, Willem's in a series of, you know, made-up film names and things.
Right.
So why is that? It's obviously part of the same fairy tale context, but let's just talk about that in a bit more detail. Why did you decide to do that?
I mean, I wanted to write a book that had a lot of absences mm-hmm. in it, and the sort of absences that I hope, you know, feel a little bit unsettling for the reader. But the main reason I took out the time was because I didn't want the reader to feel tethered by anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't want the reader to say, well, they're feeling like this because it's right after 9/11, or they're feeling like this because it's in the middle of the height of the AIDS crisis. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted the reader to only be able to concentrate on the interior worlds of these four characters. And in that way, I hope it feels intimate, but it mm-hmm. should also feel oppressive, because there really is nowhere else to go but this particular world that they've made, this particular New York within a New York. And it's not even really a New York within a New York, it's a micro-society within New York. And so when you take away external markers, I think you do two things. A, you give the reader no escape, and B, you also don't ask the reader to fill in a lot of details for himself. I hate it when I'm reading a book and, you know, they'll say something, you know, like the cliffhanger of one chapter might be, you know, and then the towers fell.
Yeah.
And then you're supposed to fill in as a reader how the characters must be mm-hmm. feeling, what the city must be feeling like, I just think it's a cheat, and it's not something that I wanted to do for this book. This book is about a very, very contained world, and for which there's no reprieve. And there's really, much like Jude's life, there's no way out of Jude's life. For the reader, there's no way out of his life either.
Well, you talk about that, like, that sort of New York microcosm, and they are, I mean, they're explicitly, well, I'll say post-racial, you know, Jude, because, you know, described as, you know, the post-man, which we can talk about in a second. But, the, you know, the ideas of race, you know, gender and sexuality are, you know, explicitly stated, but because they sort of lack that sort of wider political context, not discussed in that way. And that seems to be, that's quite a brave move, I think, at the moment when those sort of political issues are preoccupying a lot of people.
You know, it's, I think that it's, this is not obviously an overtly political book. It's about the politics, I do think, of what we mean when we ask people to heal, what we mean when we ask people to live, what we mean when we ask people to trust in this idea of repair. And in that way, I think it is a political book. But you're right, it's not out to make any larger statements about race or gender or sexuality in that sense. Sort of. I mean, I think that, you know, it's, none of these characters are meant to be stand-ins for anything larger than who they are. I would argue, though, that if it is meant to be political or sociopolitical in any greater sense, it's in its argument that we have such rigid ideas of what it means to be in a friendship versus a romantic relationship. And it's, you know, it's, it, it continues to be very, very binary, especially for men, in the way it isn't for women, who can go back and forth in terms of sexuality, and there's a great deal more fluidity. But for men, I think that's still not as possible. And, you know, two of the characters, I don't know how spoilery you want to get here, but two of the characters...
That's entirely up to
you.
Yeah,
I won't get that spoilery then. But two of the characters begin a relationship that is sexual, and I don't think either of them are gay, but I think that they do so because it's the only other model available to them. And it's quite constrictive when you have that sensation that if you're in a male friendship, that once you start expressing yourself physically, then it becomes something else. And I don't think that's true for everyone.
I almost feel now that my next question is going to give more away then, because I want us to take us to, you know, to where the book goes. And we've started off with these four characters, and then JB and Malcolm sort of recede into the background, and the book becomes more about Jude and Willem and you know, their various relationships, but specifically about Jude, and Jude becomes the focus of the book and the focus of all of the other characters. So let's talk about Jude. Who was he?
That's a great question. I think he's, to me, he's someone who is never able to, who spends his entire life trying to answer things that were done to him and is never able to. And one of the great joys of writing Jude, he's a very easy character to write because he doesn't change at all, fundamentally. And he's someone who remains hopeful that he can change himself and is hopeful till the very end of the book and is simply unable to do it. But the frustrating part about him, I think, for the reader and for his friends, is that he is never able to unlearn elemental lessons about himself that he learned as a child. And I do think that there are certain things we discover about ourselves or are told about ourselves up until maybe the age of 8 or 9. And those are the lessons that are the hardest to undo and the ones that are the most resonant. And so in him, I wanted to create a character who's lovable and has the ability to be loved, but for all of his other gifts and talents and advantages, is lacking the sorts of gifts and talents and advantages that he truly needs. You know, the gift of anger and the gift of vengeance, in a sense, and the gift of not believing what he's been told. And that, to me, is what makes him a tragic character, because he is somebody who is faithful in a lot of ways to what he's been taught.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Hanya Yanagihara, and we're talking about her book, A Little Life. And to carry on with Jude, mm-hmm. Hanya, so without giving everything away, too much yes. away, let's talk about, as much as you can, about what has happened to him.
So Jude's a character who is an orphan and was been taken in by a monastery.
I didn't even know they had monasteries. Do they have monasteries?
They do. You know, this was, in fact, I mean, this is the part where, you know, it's always the parts that sound the most unreal that are the most real. Yeah. And they, in fact, still exist. And I had an acquaintance when I was growing up who was, in fact, left at a convent to be raised. And this was in the 80s, so it wasn't so long ago. But he becomes essentially the victim of one of these monks who begins to use him sexually and is abused throughout his life. And there are people, I think, who once abused, unfortunately, people smell it on them, you know, and there are people who always are able to sense people who are vulnerable to violation and prey upon those people, and he is one of those people. And he's also someone who I wanted to make a very bifurcated character, you know, who's someone who finds success and finds joy in work and real meaning, and in his personal life is someone who is struggling daily with his memories and with his past and trying, you know, with increasing, I think, desperation to forget who he is and what he's become.
And just to pick you up on that, he will talk about how he deals with his abuse, but he is successful. He's a wildly successful lawyer. He's a brilliant lawyer. He's the, you know, the best student in his law professor's class. Who he then becomes, you've got friends with, and is eventually adopted by. He's, beyond that, he has a master's in pure mathematics, he's a mathematician, he's a fantastic baker, he unexpectedly is brilliant at sigillarias. He's a savant as well. I mean, again, there's almost a sense that his brilliance, despite the fact that he's had this so terrible upbringing, is sort of an exaggeration, I guess.
I mean, he is an exaggerated character, and I think that, but to me, what was more important was that, you know, I did give him a lot of gifts, and I gave him a lot of talents. I think the best gift I gave him was that he was able to still love and be loved. But all of those gifts mean absolutely nothing. You know, they really don't mean anything in the end to him. And I think, I won't deny that they give him pleasure, and I'm not going to say that success and money isn't important in his life because, you know, he has medical issues and they buy him good medical care. And so it is essential to his adulthood. But in the end, those talents that he has, those advantages he has, don't really do anything for him in the end.
And we haven't mentioned yet his full name. So he's called Jude St. Francis, which, I mean, he was a foundling, and he's been adopted by monks initially. He was raised by monks, so that's why. But at the same time, again, going back to that sort of idea of the, you know, of the fairy tale, there's almost a sort of religious parable element to this as well. And yet religion is a thing that's beyond the fact that he's, you know, institutionally abused by monks, is almost entirely absent from this book. And again, going back to their lives in New York, it's stated a few times that their life is explicitly an atheist life.
Right.
So let's talk about that. What's the role of religion in the book?
You know, I think that everyone looks for and craves something to believe in. And I think that one of the reasons that Jude is so, in a sense, committed to believing that he's wrong and he's deserved the things that happened to him is because if you don't believe that, if you think that the world is simply unfair or unjust, in a sense, that's a much, much crueler thing to have to accept. So, you know, if your religion becomes instead thinking that you have done something wrong, you have done something to deserve it, that the world has visited upon you its horrors and terrors, although he's not religious as an adult, it is a form of religion.
Sure.
It is, in a sense, Christianity at its most punishing, this idea that you are being punished for a reason. And that is a very sort of religious way of thinking, and the one that he carries through and has perhaps misapplied to his own life. But I think, again, the alternative would be to accept that the world is simply unfair. And that is, I think, for many people, a much, much harder thing to accept.
Can we talk about what Jude does to deal with the legacy of his abuse? Right? I'm talking about, obviously, about the cutting. There are very sort of graphic sequences regularly throughout the book where he cuts himself with a razor blade. So let's talk about that.
Well, you know, first of all, from a purely kind of textural point of view, it's it's almost like a bit of music that repeats itself in a symphony. That sort of, you know, the sort of few bars that come up again and again and again. But for his life, it's, I think, like any addiction, is a way of reclaiming the body. And any addiction is a way of destroying the body. But it's also, in those moments, whether you're doing drugs or you're anorexic or you're cutting or what have you, it's a way of asserting the self, of saying that your body is completely yours, and it's completely yours to do with whatever you want, even if it means something ruinous. And I think that is, you know, behavior that made complete sense for him. You know, it's something that, one of the things that I find that Jude really lacks and is very sad, is this sense of anger. And when you do harm yourself like this, it is anger that is, you know, directed towards yourself, and it keeps you from exploding in rage. And for him, I think the way he has made himself go through life is by suppressing and keeping in check the incredible sense of anger and frustration that he feels for the world, and rightly so.
You mentioned earlier both that Jude is, you know, he's convinced that he can get better somehow, but at the same time, he completely blames himself and believes that, you know, he was Brother Luke, the monk that abuses him and then takes him away from the monastery, tells him, you know, you were born for this.
Right.
And he believes that. That's firmly what he believes. And despite you saying that he believes he can get better, also resolutely through the book, he refuses to.
Right.
He turns away help. He doesn't help himself. This is fundamentally not a book about terrible abuse followed by a redemptive story of somebody. There's no closure.
Yes, because I feel that for a lot of people, there is no, you know, I of course know people who have been abused and have found a way to answer it and, you know, live very good lives and have made an accommodation with it. And I know people who haven't, and it does destroy them. And I know that's not a popular thing to say, and of course it's not true for everyone. And there's no one thing that will ruin one people across the board. I think it's very different for different people. But for him, I didn't think that it made sense for this character to be able to resolve a world in which this could happen to him. And in which he could be find a measure of peace with it.
You mentioned right at the beginning this idea of, you know, men not being able to express themselves necessarily in the same way as women. And as we've now, you know, revealed, this is a book about relentless abuse of a child. And this is, again, something that men are not really, they're not really equipped to deal with, to talk about, are they, in the same way that women are, perhaps?
Yes, I mean, I've said this and I've gotten, you know, in trouble for it, but, you know, I do think that all girls have been taught that sexual violence will at some point be, if not visited upon them, but there will be a threat of it. I don't know that boys have that same conversation with their parents, you know?
No, not in the slightest. And we talk about a, you know, rape culture as a thing that is there, that is omnipresent.
Right.
I don't think that's any way controversial to say that, you know, women live with the everyday threat of sexual violence much more than men do.
Right. But I suppose my bigger point was that, you know, it doesn't take away anything of your womanhood if you have been sexually mistreated, unfortunately. It's expected. But I think for many men who have suffered abuse, it makes them question their very maleness, and that's something I think that's less explored.
I'm Natalie Haynes, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
The fact that Jude has been, you know, horrifically abused in his childhood is not, you know, it's not just a thing that's used as a character trait to explain something in a plot. It is fundamental to his character, and therefore there are long sequences in this book where, you know, and it gets worse and progressively worse as it goes on. Explicit scenes of abuse. Why did you want to do that, to go into so much detail? I mean, it's often extremely hard work.
I think it's my argument to my American editor, who was concerned about the level of violence in the book, is that the reader is there as Jude's witness, and he's there as Jude's company. And I think that there's something that to be said about the respect for a character, or the respect for anyone, that you witness them in their darkest and most horrific moments. And, you know, this is a character that I hope the reader becomes invested in and learns to care about, and part of learning to care about someone versus whether it's a character or a real person is simply being present for the worst parts of their lives.
Mm-hmm. To what extent did you, I mean, how did you research the sort of stuff that goes on with you?
I didn't. I mean, it was something that came to me quite naturally. I did a lot of research about his job, about technicalities, about the sorts of things, like, which I find this is such a kind of ghoulish thing, but these adoption fairs that happen in the States.
Yeah.
So I researched how, you know, could social services fail him so thoroughly? And the answer is yes. You know, so I did a lot of technical work. But in terms of the life he actually leads, that was purely imagined.
So what was it like then for you to, I guess, to live that life as well for the length of time that you were writing this book?
Well, you know, you would be a monster if you didn't feel empathy for the character. And they were very hard sections to write. They were great sections in a lot of ways because I did know exactly where it was going. And even if you were working through very dark material as a writer, that's often overridden by the pure joy of actually knowing where you're going and feeling it come so fluidly to you. So in that sense, it was a very pleasurable writing experience. But it's very hard. You know, I didn't take any joy from it. It wasn't something that I felt was gratuitous, but I felt that I had to do it for this character because, and I felt a certain amount of respect for this character as well, and like I needed to explain to both myself and to potential readers what had actually happened to him. You know, there's an interesting, in the States I got asked a lot about this thing called trigger warnings, which I hadn't heard about until, I mean, it's been a long time since I've been in college, but I, you know, and someone had asked me, what do you think about trigger warnings, and do you think that this book should come with one? I understand the reasoning.
A big neon one.
Yes, exactly. I understand the reasoning behind them, but I think it's a very dangerous thing.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
You know, we don't know how we're going to react to something until we start reacting, and a trigger warning means that, you know, it is a disservice to both the people whose lives you're witnessing and to your own life. I mean, you cannot go around protecting yourself from art, from literature, from news, from everything. I think it's a very slippery slope.
Yeah, I think it's a thing that would have the exact opposite effect in the long run of what it's intended to
do. Yeah, I think so too. And I think people react differently. People react differently to, just as people react differently to abuse, people react differently to the memory of abuse. And I think it's quite patronizing to think that everyone's going to react the same way. But in terms of writing these sections, you know, I actually did think, for as violent as this book can be and as explicit as it can be, I was aware of how far I wanted to push it, not from a reader's perspective, but just in terms of how it felt tonally within the context of this book.
I read, I think, in an interview you did with The Guardian, that there was a series of photographs you collected that influenced the book. Diane Arbus and something. In fact, I should say Deanne Arbus, shouldn't I?
Yes.
Not to give away a joke that's in the book. But tell us about that. So how did that work?
Well, you know, I started collecting photography when I was about 26, and I, you know, although I appreciate it on a technical and artistic level, one of the things I did really respond to, and not just photography, but paintings and other works on paper as well, was I had sort of a collection of images of maybe about 40 or so that really informed this book emotionally and tonally. You know, I would look at them and think, I had always yearned to write a narrative to accompany some of these photos in particular. And some of them I loved because they suggested the sorts of mood that I wanted to capture among JB and Willem, the sense of abandon that young people have in their bodies. And so this book, I think, is it's a visual book, but it's also a book that has been heavily inspired by visuals, perhaps more than anything else. And the one sort of name brand I do use in this book is, if you can say that, are artist names, who are the sorts of, I guess, if you can say that this book can be anchored in time in any kind of way, it's through them and through their names. So it was a way to, you know, both to have the photography reflect the book and to have the book reflect photography too, and contemporary art in general.
And always a difficult question to ask in a book that's so harrowing, but I wanted to talk about other aspects of your life that might have influenced the book, and particularly in that same interview you talked about how, you know, you had quite a peripatetic life when you were a child, and, you know, one of the things that happens, you know, Judy's taken away from the monastery and basically spends, you know, a section of the book travelling, staying in, like, sort of cheap motels and things. So let's talk about that experience and how that influenced it.
Well, you know, I mean, my parents moved frequently, and to save money, they drove across country a lot. So, you know, we were living in Maryland at the time, and we drove across to California. You know, when we were living in Texas, we drove north to Toronto. And we just ended up doing a lot of driving, both because my father's beguiled with the idea of America. I mean, he is American, but loved the American landscape, and also because it was cheaper. So I did spend a lot of time in motels, and when you do move around quite a bit as a child, you know, obviously you become much more observant, mm-hmm. and you learn how to retreat and how to watch. You learn a certain sort of watchfulness. But those motels in particular affected me because they're such an indelible part of the American landscape, and they're so iconic. And one can't help, although I wasn't able to articulate this as a child, of course, but one can't help being in them to think about the transient lives and the sorts of stories that have passed through there. And it was something that deeply affected me, that sense of sort of bottom-of-the-stomach loneliness that you felt in those places, that sense that you were kind of unmoored from the rest of the world, and then also that you were in the tradition of, you know, a very American history of people who were kind of going from one place to the next, either trying to make their fortune or outrun it, was something that, as I said, I wasn't able to articulate till I was an adult, but remember being very conscious of as a kid.
I mentioned earlier that you're still working. You've written this is your second novel. You work for a New York magazine. It's not an inconsiderable novel. It's 700 pages plus. So not only that, but as we've already discussed, it's a book about a rather harrowing subject. So how did that writing process go? How did you manage to fit it in?
It was, I was just very disciplined about it. And I, as I said, I had so much of the book that it was actually a matter of physics, really just sitting down and actually doing it and time and it was parsing that time. And it was a relief to get to work, too, in a lot of ways, because to have an escape from this book. And then I was very consistent about how I wrote it, and I knew from writing the first book what my shortcomings were as a writer, purely on a labor level. I knew where I was going to get bored and when I was going to start wanting to trail off into just kind of laziness. So in that sense, it was a much easier book to write. And I also loved the story. I knew where I was going with it. It's always easier when you have that. But and also it was a time in my job in which I felt I understood the job. I was comfortable in it. I knew what I was doing. And so everything just sort of aligned. I don't know that it could ever happen again, though.
Well, I've actually seen you say that you're not even sure if you'll write again. I mean, that may well have been before this book was shortlisted for the Booker Prize.
I don't know, Sal. I have a new job now. I started in June, and it's been all consuming, and so I really haven't had weekends even to write. And I do have an idea for something else, but it's going to take a huge amount of research, mm-hmm. and I really hate research, so I haven't started doing anything yet, except for very preliminary stuff.
But if this was the last thing you wrote, it would be a good one. Perhaps in 40 years' time, when you're senile, another draft of it will emerge in which June is a massive racist.
Yeah, exactly.
Or something.
Exactly.
Just a final question then. So what did it mean to be shortlisted to you for the Booker?
I mean, it's the biggest thrill. This is the award that I grew up following and obviously never thought I would be eligible for until last year. And it's the most meaningful nomination I could have hoped for.
I've been talking to Hanya Yanagihara. We've been talking about her book, A Little Life, which is out now from Picador. So Hanya, thank you very much for taking the time to tell me about it.
Neil, thank you so much.
I'm James Ward, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Anthony Lowenstein is an independent journalist and a documentary filmmaker with a column in The Guardian. He has written for the BBC, The Nation, Al Jazeera, The Washington Post, and many other publications. He's the author of three previous books, My Israel Question, The Blogging Revolution, and Prophets of Doom. He's the co-editor of After Zionism and Left Turn and the co-author of For God's Sake, and he's currently working on a documentary about disaster capitalism, which is also the subject of his latest book, Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. So, Anthony, thanks for talking to Little Atoms today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So, disaster capitalism. Let's talk about what that term means. Mm-hmm. First of all, it was coined by Naomi Klein, and you've sort of expanded the brief of it a bit in this book.
Yeah, so in her book in 2007 called The Shock Doctrine, some listeners may know, she talked about particularly focusing on the issue of organisations, individuals, corporations getting exploitation from natural and man-made disasters. And I read that book, I liked the book, I wanted to expand the thesis of that. So what I've done in this book is to draw on some of her work, but also deeply expand on it. So particularly focusing on, which she didn't do so much, on immigration, privatised immigration in the US, UK, Greece, Australia and elsewhere. And also the aid and development industry, which she touches on to some extent in post-Sri Lanka tsunami. And I guess you could say also Hurricane Katrina in the US in 2005, but I've deepened that as well. So it's based on her thesis to an extent, but really expanded on it. And to me, it comes down to looking at why the corporation has become more powerful than the state. I think many people will say that is probably true in certain countries, but why does it happen? And often it's about following the money. Not surprising to hear that, but I've done a lot of investigation in various countries, including here in the UK, to explain why that works. This is really a bipartisan issue. It doesn't really matter in the UK if you have a Labour or Tory Prime Minister. In the US, Republican or Democrat, in Australia, Conservative or Labour Prime Minister. There are differences, to be sure, but overall, it's very much the same. And that really goes to the heart of, I think, why people are making so much money for misery. And a lot of people have said to me, well, that's inherently about capitalism. That's been happening since time immemorial. That's true to an extent. I mean, I've recently been reading a lot about the East India Company, which was arguably the world's first disaster capitalist company, exploited very successfully from its own perspective in India, of course, and also in China. But the difference, I think, these days in the 21st century is the massive globalized nature of it. And also, I would argue that in an age of mass corporatization, an unwillingness or inability of many in the political sphere, and I talk extensively in the media sphere, to question that. And that, to me, I think, is a real problem.
And actually, I think something like the East India Company is a good analogy here, because in those days, there were, you know, very few, obviously, you know, the British Empire being the leading proponent of this, but the work was done by a very small number of, you know, massively powerful companies. And that's the way that things are developing now, in that power seems to be concentrating into a very, very small group of companies.
It does, and that's inherently a problem. And I suppose one of the things that I talk about in the book is that I'm not arguing, for example, that if, say, all England's detention centres were run by the state, that makes them good, or that makes them okay, or they'd be utopian. I mean, the issue, for example, is a culture, political and media, that says that locking people up is a good idea. Immigrants, prisoners. The US, of course, is a far greater problem where you have huge culture of mass incarceration. Listeners may be aware of these, but some of these facts are pretty startling. You have about 2.3 million Americans in jail today, roughly. The vast majority, of course, are minorities, African American and Hispanics, Latinos. Around 6 million are people in some form of correctional organization that could be on parole, but some kind of association. It's an insane number of people. It's the greatest number in history, far outstrips any other country, China, Iran, whatever it may be, in the 21st century. And what is less known is that there are a lot of corporations that are pretty happy about that situation, and they worry about a President Obama or a future president seriously reforming that system. Now, Obama has tinkered around the edges, like on so much with President Obama. Nothing much radically is going to change before he leaves office in roughly a year and a half. But there is real fear, and there's certain companies such as CCA and Geo Group, who are America's largest privatized immigration and prison company, in their annual reports regularly talk about their worry about what reform means, reform being less people locked up, essentially. And they are, at the moment, almost guaranteed to be very excited about the possibility of a Donald Trump presidency. And we sort of laugh about that even being possible. I don't think it's likely, but only a fool having to spend time in the US would say it's impossible. It's not impossible. And one of the policies that Trump is talking about, as some listeners may be aware, is deporting the 11 million undocumented migrants who reside in the US, mostly from South America and Latin America. Now, it's not feasible, it's not going to work, it's not going to really happen, but in the time between if he wins president, God forbid, and the reality of that policy being implemented, that involves putting a lot of people behind bars. And that means a lot of detention centres and facilities needing to be used. Who's going to run those centres? Mm-hmm. Private companies. And that reality and that nexus is too rarely discussed. There's one final point on this. The US presidential campaign at the moment, there's three leading candidates who are receiving a lot of money from the private prison industry. Hillary Clinton on the Democrat side, Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush on the Republican side. Now, I'm not saying that their policies on these issues, which are mostly awful, are solely because of that. Mm-hmm. But let's face it, if you're getting money, and the thing of the American system, and to some extent here in the UK and in my country, Australia as well, but in the US, it is such on greater scale. It's the legalized nature of money giving. It's not illegal. You can give, as a private prison company, a hell of a lot of money to your favored candidate and almost guarantee you're going to get a nice favor from that candidate. That doesn't mean you're going to get money yourself, but a policy that is amenable to your needs. And that, to me, is a major problem with political donations in the modern age.
And we've already said, you've mentioned that, you know, people have suggested that this is a thing that's been going on since time immemorial. This is what capitalism is all about. But there is, you know, there's definitely a sense in that things have intensified over the last however many tens of years, probably. So what? Let's talk about what changed. What are the reforms that have made power intensify into these, you know, fewer companies? The, you know, the removal of regulation from governments and things. What changed?
So I think 9/11 was a big shift, but let me just go back one before we get to 9/11. In the 80s particularly, and I talk about this in the book, Reagan in the US, Thatcher in the UK, very much had the belief, ideologically, that the state's role should be reduced. Mm-hmm. In their mind, too much state control meant too much association with, say, the evil unions. That's the way they viewed it, not the way I view it. And the way to deal with that was to outsource a lot of public services. That included healthcare, that included prisons and other areas. And they did that to some extent with a great deal of public resistance. I mean, what's fascinating about this area is that from that period to now, in most Western countries, when the public are polled about what they think about, say, a privatized hospital, they mostly oppose it. This doesn't mean it's actually not happening, though. In other words, it's often happened despite public opposition. So over the years, various public services have been privatized, often by stealth, though, rather than all at the same time. 9/11 happens, obviously, and I think what happened there is, particularly in the US, but also in the UK and the Australia and elsewhere in Europe, a belief somehow that because there was going to be so much war making, Afghanistan first, then Iraq, since then there's been the war on Libya and other smaller conflicts, that if you're going to pursue war, an endless war essentially, it makes sense to outsource that under the guise of efficiency, but in reality, less accountability. So one of the interesting things, I found a fascinating speech by Donald Rumsfeld, who was the former US Defense Secretary, on September the 10th, 2001, the day before 9/11, giving a speech to the Pentagon, essentially saying that the real threat to the US wasn't terrorism, it was too much spending. So, ironically, 9/11 happens, and this gave the Bush administration the perfect explanation and justification to be able to outsource war. So what that means is two things. One, everything from the US and Britain goes into Afghanistan, and that may be South Asian workers ironing their clothes. That's not a military sense, that's just doing kind of basic tasks. In a more concerning way, though, is the US and to some extent Britain and Australia have outsourced their counterterrorism policy. So one of the real revelations of the Snowden documents in the last few years, Edward Snowden, is that the vast majority of people involved with the NSA in the US, MI6 and various other intelligence organizations around the world is they're privatized. So we have essentially allowed vast numbers of companies and individuals without any, in theory, checks and balances to be able to monitor and tag all of us on a day-to-day basis. So,
can I just interrupt you there? Because there's a fact in the book where you mentioned that there's something like 4 million people that are in some way at a high level of security clearance in the US in terms of, you know, in terms of surveillance, like workers.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that to me is a figure that is more staggering than the fact that there are 6 million people in prison. That's just,
it's amazing, that's just, isn't it?
Where do all these people work?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, one of the things that Snowden talks about, and this is why I think his revelations are so important, and this is really goes against what the narrative about Snowden has been in much of the mainstream press, is that, yes, the US, the UK, Australia, and the other key Western allies who are aligned to the US claim that this is about countering terrorism and extremism, whether it's Al-Qaeda or ISIS or whatever. And yes, that's part of it. But what Snowden's documents show is that this is mostly about gaining economic advantage. that's the unspoken truth about the Snowden revelations, in a way, that really says that what the US and its allies are trying to do is win economic benefits for the governments and the corporations in those countries. That's what it's about. So to gain advantage over your competitor or your country's competitor, whatever it may be. That's what it's about. You ask, what are those 4 million workers all doing? Who knows what they're all doing, but certainly Snowden has regularly said that he would routinely, and he was a private contractor, he was working for the NSA, but for a private corporation, he said he would regularly have the ability to be able to access pretty much anybody's information through an email address, whatever it may be, daily. Personal details, this wasn't about terrorism. It was not about that. So you ask, before, what changed in the society to allow this huge outsourcing to happen in the last 20, 30, 40 years? I think it very much is a belief somehow that the media increasingly has often accepted the narrative. So there are exceptions in the press who don't, but often many journalists and editors do think it's somehow wonderful to have more detention centres run by private companies, despite the fact that they routinely have abuses within them. Or isn't it wonderful to think that we could build more hospitals if they're run by a private corporation? So I'm not saying that by definition any facility run by a private corporation is evil, far from it. However, the record of detention centres and hospitals and war making and aid and development run by private corporations around the world, including here in Britain, is pretty awful. And often it's awful for public organisations or public facilities as well. But at least there's the possibility of more accountability with those.
I'm Andrew Muller. Check out the growing Little Atoms media empire at littleatoms.com.
I think anybody looking at, you know, the idea of private corporations running the giant incarceration industry, for instance, in America and now latterly more so in Britain, there are obvious conflicts of interest. So you can see why, you know, clearly it's in their interest to have more people locked up. So the idea of there being some sort of redemptive thing about sending somebody to prison
is a problem for them.
Becomes a problem for them, exactly. But let's talk about perhaps in terms of the sort of disaster capitalism thing, what are the reasons that would make a private corporation less well suited for quickly going in and clearing up after an earthquake or something, for instance, because it might be more difficult to see why that would be an issue.
So one of the things that came up, it's not so much in the book, but it's obviously happened since the book came out, was the devastating earthquake in Nepal a few months ago. So you had a situation in Nepal, there were thousands killed, mostly locals who were living in awfully built houses, the earthquake happens and their lives are destroyed instantly. There are companies called Global Rescue, which are often used by Western aid workers or journalists. And they've written, or should I say journalists, have written about what that means practically. So let's say you're in Nepal and Kathmandu, the earthquake happens. You somehow contact them and say, get me out, the airport is closed, or the runway has been cracked, or whatever it may be. Or you're in a more remote area. What that means practically is that Global Rescue, as a private company, is going to be fighting with publicly funded rescue services for the few helicopters to get you out. That's what it means in practice. So I'm not saying that as a Westerner you're less worthy to be saved, but on a purely numbers game, and I don't know, if you're based there, you're going to want to get out and survive. I understand that. We all would. But in a practical reality, in that sort of situation, it was pretty startling. They are fighting over very few resources. They haven't got their own helicopters. They haven't got their own rescue services. So they're really trying to get and they gave an example of rescuing people from the base of Everest. And a lot of locals who are in desperate medical care. And then there was you, for example, who was fine but wanted to get out of the country. They're going to choose you over them because you're paying your annual fee and they're not. That's what it means. That, to me, is deeply problematic. And I don't think it's not illegal, but I think it's ethically problematic. I think it's morally problematic. I think it also breeds profound anger towards not just Westerners, but foreign interests in these countries themselves. I also give examples in the book of Haiti, just briefly. So there was an earthquake there in 2010, in January 2010, where there were roughly 200,000 people killed, a hell of a lot of people. I've spent time there twice in the last few years. And there's a great WikiLeaks cable that was released in 2010, which shows that the then US ambassador, when the earthquake hit, viewed the situation, in his words, as a gold rush. Now, what a gold rush means is that particularly US corporations could make a killing in that country. So USAID, which is the American government arm to distribute aid and development, was giving billions of dollars of contracts, but most of that money stayed in the US. didn't go to Haitians. It didn't go to Haitian people to be trained or educated. It went to US contractors. And that, to me, again, is problematic. So years on after the earthquake, it's now 5.5 years on, yes, there's been a few new roads, and I'm not saying nothing has got better, but overall, the political situation is dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. And the US, for example, through its aid policies, views a solution to that country as, apart from giving contracts to US contractors, building industrial parks. What industrial parks, another word for, is sweatshops to make clothes that Americans can buy in Walmart and The Gap. Mm-hmm. That's what it means. And Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and Chelsea Clinton, their daughter, were key proponents of this. So now that Hillary is running for president, and she was Secretary of State during the Obama years when the earthquake happened, she made massive claims about industrial parks were going to bring Haitians out of poverty. It was all bullshit. Mm-hmm. Because the facts on the ground show that virtually no jobs were given anyway, and made worse by the fact that people who did get jobs are getting underpaid and woeful working conditions. And too often I think the press doesn't ask the question beyond, oh, Hillary Clinton in the US is giving $5 billion. Isn't that great? Yeah, it's great on paper, but what, you know, what's the reality 5 years on? Mm-hmm. And in Haiti, having private industry trying to support a struggling country. Haiti is the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. It's incredibly poor. This is actually only worsening the problem. And that, to me, is an issue that we should look at.
And just one other thing before we move on to look at some of the examples on the ground in some of the countries you visited. I guess in a wider context, the world is, you know, going through a situation at the moment in terms of climate change, which these big corporations are not, they would obviously not be the right people to deal with the consequences, but more specifically, it isn't in their best interest to do so in the first place.
Absolutely not. And in fact, I give some examples in the book, although Naomi Klein in her latest book, This Changes Everything, goes into greater detail about that. There's also a great book our listeners would encourage by a guy called Mackenzie Funk. It's a great name. His book is called Windfall, came out last year, and it really goes into detail about the corporations that are very, very happy about climate change. They're making serious money. This is everything from insurance companies to, for example, in California now, you have private firefighters. So let's say you're living in a small Californian town, and bushfires is a big problem over there in summer in California. You have two homes near each other. One has a private firefighter company on their books and one doesn't. What it means in practice is that a fire comes and the private firefighting organization will try to put your fire out, but not the guy next door who doesn't have it. Now, obviously, the fire could extinguish both homes, but that's the business model that is being used. Or, for example, private security companies giving you protection around your home after a natural disaster to avoid looters. This is not a dystopian future. It's happening now in many, many areas, mostly in the West, but also in the non-Western world too. So you're right. The companies that have caused climate change, unless they're incredibly, not just savvy, but humanitarian in a way, would see a necessary need to change their business practice. And one thing that came out, in fact, this recently was, some listeners may have seen this, that although for decades a company like ExxonMobil has been at the forefront of supporting and funding climate denier organizations, what emerged recently through documents that got released in the US is Exxon itself knew from the late 70s that climate change was a problem. They knew it themselves, and there were scientists in the organization doing the research. They'd been commissioned by management to discover what maybe was going to be happening to climate change. They knew. They made a corporate decision in the 80s, of course, to not do anything about it and pursue not just dirty energy through their policies, but also fund climate deniers to deny the science as well. So it's sort of weird in a way thinking about that. I'm not suggesting that Exxon is going to solve our climate change problem. Of course they won't, clearly. But it's fascinating to think, like you will, I think, like we saw years ago with tobacco companies, who clearly knew that cigarettes were killing their clients. They didn't give a shit because it was making them money. The difference, I think, now is, have we learned the lessons from the 50s, 60s and 70s about tobacco to apply to these kind of companies that are causing economic destruction and social destruction through climate change policies? The issue, therefore, is, does the state have a role in punishing companies that are doing that? I would argue yes. Now, what that means is obviously is a country-by-country basis, but the idea, for example, that the vast majority of the Western world, I'm talking about governments here rather than the peoples, aren't really serious about addressing climate change. Now, the result of that in practical terms is that we're likely to get 2-degree temperature rising by the end of this century, by 2100, which is going to affect deeply a hell of a lot of countries around the world. And just finally, I've just been living this year in South Sudan, and one of the things you see there and in countries near there in East Africa is many British and American, Chinese and Indian companies buying up massive amounts of land for food crops. Mm-hmm. And that food is not designed for locals, that's designed for Westerners. And that's another sign that climate change clearly is reducing arable land around the world. Desertification is clearly increasing. So again, it's a case of far away from most Western journalists' eyes is happening around the world now.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Anthony Lowenstein, and we're talking about his book Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. And Anthony, I want us to move on then to look at some of the countries that you visit. Tell us about the people you spoke to, what the situation was like on the ground and that. And the book is split into two parts in this respect, in that first of all, you look at some of the places, a couple of places you've already mentioned, Haiti, Greece, where the usual suspects are exploiting the local population for profit. But then also, perhaps more surprisingly, you look at the USA, the UK and Australia, the people who are doing that thing, in terms of how those countries, have outsourced ways in which they can exploit their own citizens. But first of all, let's look at a few examples of places. So Pakistan and Afghanistan is where you start off. As I said, you've visited all of these places. You've seen what the situation is like. In the chapter about Pakistan and Afghanistan, you talk about, the sort of the after effect of the war on terror, and particularly in terms of this sort of like privatisation of the military and mercenaries and things. So let's talk about what you saw.
So I've been to Afghanistan twice in the last few years, 2012 and also this year in 2015. And you're right, I was looking really at two things particularly. One, how since the US invaded in Afghanistan in 2001, and Pakistan's not technically occupied country, but in many ways many Pakistanis would argue it is actually occupied by the US, or for that matter, the Taliban, in a way, the Pakistani Taliban. So different kind of occupation, but occupation nonetheless. In Afghanistan, you're absolutely right, there was huge outsourcing to private security companies, so-called Afghan and foreign, to often, for example, transport American military goods from point A to point B. And what is less known about that was that to be able to ensure a safe passage, the US, through US tax dollars, and for that matter the British and Australian troops as well, had to pay private security companies who were then paying the Taliban to not shoot at them. That's how it worked. So in a weird kind of absurd way, you had a situation in all these countries where we're basically paying our enemy not to shoot at us, except when they shoot at us. That's how it was working. So suffice to say, in many of the areas where private security, Afghan and foreign, were operating, I spoke to a great number of locals who would often have these companies come through their villages, kill them, kidnap them, torture them, affect them, destroy their crops. These are very, very poor people, so they're basically living on agriculture, if that, and often in certain parts of the country, opium and as well. I didn't look into the drug issue so much, but that clearly Afghanistan provides 90% of the world's heroin. I mean, and the US occupation, in fact, has made that far, those figures much higher. I mean, it's remarkable to think that, and I'm far from an apologist for the Taliban at all, but when the Taliban were in power until 2001, that industry had basically stopped. I mean, they were an awful human rights abusing organization as well, of course, group. But the drug trade since those years has hugely expanded, massively so. And the US is pretty much acquiesced and accepted that in many ways. So the private security industry was one. The other thing I looked at, I was there again this year in May, and I'm also working, as you said, on a film with a New York filmmaker called Thor Newrider, and we're looking at Afghanistan, Haiti, and Papua New Guinea. And in Afghanistan, the focus mainly was the resource and mining industry there. People maybe don't realize that there are estimated to be about $3 to $4 trillion US dollars of resources under the ground. Mm-hmm. Huge amounts of money. When the Soviets occupied Afghanistan and they discovered this fact, they were kicked out. The US comes in 2001, and they haven't done a lot with those resources. But the reason why this is a major, major problem and covers disaster capitalism so disastrously is that the Afghan government and the US government now claim this would be a way maybe to fund Afghanistan's future when Western and US aid disappears. It's delusional because the country is corrupt beyond belief, insecurity is rampant, there's a huge insurgency. It's completely ridiculous to even imagine that happening. But the US government has over the years given hundreds of millions of dollars in taxpayer funds to try to support an indigenous resource industry. Failed on every single front. And I went a few months ago to an area called Logar Province, which is an hour from Kabul. Very close, but it's Taliban territory. And there's a mine there called Aynak, which is run by the Chinese. It is the largest untapped copper deposit in the world. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese, as they often do, in a very savvy sense, far more so than the Americans, with no troops on the ground in Afghanistan, have bought the rights to this mine about 8 years ago now, but nothing has been mined yet because they discovered there were these Buddhist relics and they had to remove them, and it's all a bit of a disaster. But the bottom line is that we spent time, my film partner and I, with locals in the area who basically were saying that we don't want to mine here because A, we get no money from it, B, we've been displaced from our homes, C, we can't earn a living from the fields, D, we are seen as suspect by the Taliban. There's also a growing presence now, tragically, in Afghanistan of ISIS, or at least groups who associate themselves with the Islamic State. So we wanted to really examine where this push was coming from in a country like Afghanistan for a resource industry. And we really found, and my book goes into this in detail as well, not one country in the world where a developing nation, which is resource rich, does not end up becoming incredibly poor. I can't think of one. And that goes to the heart of how this system operates, that whether you believe that mining should happen at all, I in many ways think it should not. But if it is going to happen, it has to be done in a way that is environmentally friendly, which some would argue is a contradiction in terms. So let's say that's possibly true. But in Afghanistan, one final point, a lot of Afghans sort of said to us, who are you as an outsider? Even people who are critical of the industry there. Who are you as an outsider to say to us, as a nation that has seen war for now 40-odd years, who are you to say to us that there should not be a mining industry here? How are we going to get money? Mm-hmm. Like, the country's at war, and there's no simple answer to that, but I would argue that to have an industry without some kind of checks and balances guarantees more violence and insecurity, which is what's happening now.
You go to Greece, and Greece is possibly the one country that you look at in this book that will be most familiar to people because, you know, it's on the news every night at the moment.
For all the wrong reasons.
So, well, let's talk about perhaps why those reasons should be. I mean, you talk in the book about we saw the rise of the Golden Dawn, and then, you know, latterly we've seen Syriza in power. Mm. And I think, you know, most people will have an idea of, you know, the sort of duplicity of the EU in what's happened in Greece. But that's particularly what I wanted to talk about. So let's talk about what should be on the news then.
Well, I think Greece is a really interesting example, isn't it? Because Syriza, as listeners will be aware, won the election in January this year, 2015. They won another election in September this year. So they have a mandate. There's no question about that. Golden Dawn, the neo-Nazi party, remains the third largest party in the parliament. And I fear, this is a slight aside, that the far right across Europe are only going to grow in the coming years, not least because Europe is utterly incapable of dealing with the huge migrant influx in North Africa and the Middle East, and the far right often benefits from that. So Syriza came into power with a lot of hope. Certainly on the left globally and in Europe, there was a belief that a strongly left party would be able to come into power, resist the European Union and the IMF's crazy austerity, which has not worked. But I spent time with a lot of people who are deeply suffering from the most basic lack of food, or people, for example, who can't get decent healthcare. I don't think people actually really realize the real social effects of these crazy austerity policies. But I would argue that Syriza has been absolute disaster that has capitulated in the worst way imaginable, made a decision, and I guess the whole reality of why this decision was made hasn't really come out. Mm-hmm. That was a gun to their head, to be sure. There's been evidence that's emerged that clearly showed that the European Union didn't really care that there'd been a change of government in Greece. As far as they were concerned, there was a policy in place. You guys, as Syriza, are going to continue it or nothing. That's the option. You have no option. That's the option. So really, I think Syriza made a decision, and I personally feel it was arguably a mistake, that looking seriously at exiting the EU was unimaginable. Economically, it was going to be potentially disastrous. Let's try to get the best deal we can within a very narrow, austerity-minded thought. But they actually have a worse deal than they had before. There's going to be mass privatization of services, which is going to make services even worse, lesser salaries. And the thing that's really sad in Greece now is that's now locked in place for years. So yes, Greece has got massive amounts of coverage this year through the economic and political turmoil. I fear that'll decrease in the coming years because Syriza has made a deal with the devil, in my view. And I think ultimately the question about what Greece has gone through and how both Syriza and the EU dealt with it, I think is a very important lesson for both the left but also the euro, which is to say that it's very clear that in many countries, including here in Britain and parts of Europe, the belief in a united Europe is crumbling. Now, I'm not suggesting that the European Union is going to collapse tomorrow. Of course it won't. But I think it's likely, both for how Greece was treated plus the migrant issue, which the EU is utterly unwilling and incapable of dealing with, that people's belief on the left and the right for different reasons in the viability of the euro is decreasing. Now, what that means, who the hell knows, but I think it's likely that if there are going to be votes, as I know there will be here in the UK and probably other parts of Europe, the idea in 10, 20 years' time of a unified Europe expanding, which is what it always talks about doing, it might, but I think it's unlikely. And the lesson from Greece is, which is a lesson both for the left and also for Syriza, is that if you go into an election promising a massive shift and you're promising to end austerity or at least to curtail it, but in fact within a matter of months you wholeheartedly embrace it, the voices of many Greek people are not being heard in this, and having spent, as I said, time there speaking to many of them, they know, even though they voted again for Syriza in September, there wasn't much of an alternative. And the reality is that economically that country's going to suffer more for no discernible reason. Austerity does not work. No serious economist looks at Greece and says, yes, 6 years of austerity has improved the economy. In fact, it's made it worse. So the question really is not just how the Greek people deal with it, and I look about that in the book, but also economically why you have an undemocratic, unelected European Union imposing a policy that they know doesn't work. It's about pride and their ego, and their ego needs to be broken, in my humble view.
I'm Caitlin Doty, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a podcast about ideas and culture.
Let's move on to Haiti. As you said, you've been a couple of times recently, and we mentioned the 2010 quake. You talk in the book about how, you know, I mean, pretty much everybody that's there, government agencies, NGOs, you know, charities and aid groups and whatever, are all going down the route of outsourcing essential rescue services. Why?
It's a good question, Neil. There's no simple answer, but I won't give you a long-winded one. But I guess the short answer is that aid delivery has increasingly become privatized. And I think many listeners maybe aren't aware of that. So, for example, when a disaster strikes, and here in the UK, the major charities will be asking for money for a donation. I can't speak for all of them, but many of them, the aid delivery will be outsourced to a private corporation. Or, for example, it'll be subcontracted to another organization. And a good example recently has been the American Red Cross, which, after the Haitian earthquake, put out a huge appeal and raised over $1 billion. What emerged in a great journalistic investigation through Frontline in the US this year is that when the Red Cross in the US put that appeal out in 2010, what they didn't say was that they basically had nobody on the ground there. So when they were delivering the aid, sort of, they had no real experience doing it. They had no real expertise. They had no real desire to actually empower or train Haitians in the process. And the danger of aid delivery that does not actually empower locals is pretty obvious. Namely, that when those organizations leave, which they inevitably will, What's left? If you don't train locals, empower locals, I'm not saying that a local is always more experienced than a foreigner. There are going to be times where, for example, a Haitian doesn't have the expertise or experience to do the work. I understand that. But in so many cases, countless organizations simply mostly ignored Haitians entirely. So it's almost like you're delivering aid for whose purpose? For your own bottom line. And one of the things I talk about in the book and we're trying to do in the film is not to be make everyone cynical about aid and development organizations, but to ask people to be more questioning of those organizations. Do you know where the money is going? Not just in administrative fees, which is often the fear, and that's obviously a problem too, you know, paying and people getting paid in their offices in London and New York. People should get paid, of course, salaries, but too often that money is not actually going to the people themselves. And the American Red Cross example I just mentioned, despite the American Red Cross claiming they've built thousands of homes, there's no evidence for it. I mean, it's just there's no evidence that they've actually done that. So inevitably, when the next disaster strikes, people should be, in my view, far more skeptical about, as one example, that organization. So why is aid increasingly privatized? Because I think also we live under this illusion that NGOs are benign, that somehow we have this, I think in the last 40 years, as many people on the left at least have become more skeptical of not just corporations, but also government delivery. NGOs, non-government organizations, have grown out of that almost as a sort of a third way to not just administer help outside the West, but also, of course, sometimes help in the UK or US or Australia or whatever. And many of them do amazingly great work. But too often we ignore two things. One, they're often for profit. It doesn't, again, make them bad. It just means that their reason for doing things is not simply that benign. And secondly, there's too often little accountability. So when NGOs go into various conflict zones or natural disaster zones, do they have the experience to do the work? Do they actually have a fundamental belief that locals should be employed, trained, listened to? And really, one of the things that is a theme in the book and the film is a pretty basic plea. Listen to people on the ground. One very quick example. In Haiti, the earthquake happens in 2010, and the US and other aid organizations imported massive amounts of bottled water. And initially there was a need for that because the systems were so screwed up. But in time, it was not necessary anymore. There was water around, but the water kept on coming in. Another example. The US and Haiti have such a dysfunctional relationship that although there was plenty of food to feed Haitians after the earthquake, the US imported massive amounts of food from the US because the trade deal that Haiti has been forced to sign with the US means that American farmers are more important than Haitian ones. So you had all this Haitian-produced food sitting in Haiti that could have gone to Haitians, not going to Haitians. So that's an insane situation, right? It's insane. And that's partly about the fact that the US views Haiti as a client state and doesn't really respect its independence. And a lot of the countries I speak to, go to in the book, are only independent on paper. In reality, Afghanistan, I would argue Greece, I would argue even Australia and Britain are not independent countries. They have governments and prime ministers and presidents. Of course they do. And decisions are made not solely based on foreign interests. But when it comes to, for example, war making, certainly in your country here and in my country, Australia, I don't regard it as independent at all. We are being dictated to or a sense somehow that we can't disappoint our American friends by not going into Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or Libya or wherever it may be. That to me is a problem.
The last of these countries that you look at, Papua New Guinea, it's a place that is one of the biggest recipients of aid from Australia, your own country. Another place that's blessed with, you know, abundant natural resources that outside companies want to mine. So let's talk about what's happening.
So most people don't know much about this country, which is sad because it's a country to the north of Australia. It is, as you say, one of the richest nations in the world, richest in terms of its resources, but it's been raped and pillaged for years. In 1975, it became independent from Australia. It was an Australian colony before that, or I guess you'd say protected, but basically a colony. And I focus on a province called Bougainville, which was the site of a massively profitable Rio Tinto copper mine from the 70s to the 80s. In short, the locals were being shafted, they weren't getting any benefits, they were getting crappy pay, the mine was causing huge pollution in the area, and the locals rose up, in short, took up arms after trying to negotiate for better conditions and didn't achieve anything through Rio Tinto. It was a 10-year civil war. Rio Tinto received support from the Papua New Guinean government, the US government, the Australian government, the British government. They still lost. So the Bougainvillians won that war. The mine shut down, but at a huge, huge cost. You go there today, and I talk about this in the book, it's like visiting a Mad Max set. There's this kind of weird sense of everything being stuck in time. Mm-hmm. There are petrol stations that were burnt out during the war in the 80s that have simply just remained burnt out. They haven't been rebuilt. They're just sort of sitting there, almost waiting for something, but people sort of hang out there, kind of a lot of guys loitering and drinking. It's a really dysfunctional situation. The reason I want to mention, apart from the fact that virtually no one knows about it outside, even my country, let alone globally, it was one of the most brutal civil wars in the Asia-Pacific region over the last 40 years, and no one really knows much about it, is that there's now talk about reopening the mine. Mm-hmm. Rio Tinto wants to get back in there. And one of the conditions of the peace deal that was struck between Papua New Guinea and Bougainville in the late 90s was, we will grant you a referendum on independence between 2015 and 2020. So 2015 is now here, and it's not going to be a vote this year, but possibly in the coming years. The powers that be, Rio Tinto, the Bougainvillean government, the Papua New Guinean government, the Australian government, all say the only way you can be independent, Bougainville, is reopening that mine. That's the only way you're going to get revenue. And the truth is, yet again, locals are simply being ignored. Most locals don't want the mine. The ones who were alive during the last war know how awful it was, point one. And point two, younger Bougainvillians who weren't alive have heard stories from older family members, and they know that there is no way that without any kind of... There's been no accountability, there's been no environmental cleanup, there's been no kind of compensation for what Rio Tinto did the last time. So it was important for me to talk about this in the book because I think it shows two things briefly. One, that it is possible actually for locals to win against a massive multinational at a huge cost. I'm not by any means minimizing that. A massive social, human cost. And secondly, the fact that Rio Tinto and others are like cockroaches. You basically can't really kill them. They lost the war. They were destroyed in Bougainville. They pulled out. They withdrew. Fast forward 20 years, and they frame themselves now as the saviour. Only we can come back into Bougainville and help you lovely poor black people get independence. That's how it's framed in such a parochial and patronising way. And apart from the fact that locals aren't being heard who are opposing that, there's also a sense somehow that Rio Tinto, which is a major, one of the world's biggest mining companies, who operates in often appalling conditions around the world, should be held to account. And I think the way to do that in a practical way, probably for citizens, say, in the West, is divestment or putting pressure on their share price or, for example, aiming to try to, as I said, convince governments to not invest with them or vice versa because of their bad human rights practices. That, I think, is happening in a very slow way, but it's encouraging.
I'm John Grindrod, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
We're sort of running short on time. I mentioned that in the second part of the book, you look at the USA, the UK and Australia, ways in which they are perhaps exploiting their own populations. The USA and the UK we'll skip over because we touched a little bit on in the first half about the privatisation of prisons. So let's focus on Australia. And actually, in the book, you look at a way in which we're not talking about Australian citizens here explicitly. Australia has completely privatised its detention centres for asylum seekers. And let's talk about how that came about.
So Australia is the only Western country in the world that I'm incredibly not proud of that has outsourced all its detention centres to private companies. On the mainland, to Serco, which of course listeners will know is a British multinational. And Australia also has established something called the so-called Pacific Solution, which is an Orwellian term, if ever there was one, that there are detention camps on Nauru, which is a Pacific island, and also Manus Island, which is part of Papua New Guinea. And in the last years, thousands and thousands of people came by boat from Indonesia to Australia, mostly from Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, all the places you'd expect. And that's a long, long way to come. People often fly to parts of Asia, to Indonesia, then catch the boat, the relatively short distance but often dangerous journey from Indonesia to Australia. And in the last years, both major sides of politics, both the Labor Party and in my country, they're called the Liberal Party, but the Conservative Party, have decided with regrettably probably a great deal of public support to lock people up in privatised detention camps on Pacific Islands where conditions are appalling. There are not just legitimate claims, but real claims of torture, of children being sexually abused and raped. And what's remarkable about this policy is that Australia, on the one hand, claims that it's an open multicultural country, and in many ways you go to parts of Sydney or Melbourne, and yes, there's a wide diversity of people from across the globe. But since the 1990s, when this policy, not Pacific Solutions so much, but privatising detention camps began, there has been almost a belief, this is obviously before 9/11, a belief somehow that it was much better to lock people up and not actually have to deal with hearing their voices. In other words, there was almost a silencing of these people. And 9/11 happens, and we all know what happened after that, putting aside the foreign wars. It was far easier to say, all these people coming by boat are terrorists. Well, they could be terrorists. You insert in people's mind that possibility of doubt. They could be Al-Qaeda. I mean, there's no evidence that any of them were whatsoever. Zero. And the majority of people who were coming by boat were found to be refugees by Australian government officials. But the difference was that a lot of Australians, sadly, over many, many years, have accepted the rationale that it's okay to lock people up. And weirdly, though, just those coming by boat. You can fly in by plane and it's fine. I mean, I'm not saying you're going to be accepted, but I mean that it's Australians are far more willing to listen to people's claims. There's something deeply, deeply psychological in some Australians' minds about people coming by boat. Almost the weird invasion myth that used to exist in many parts of Australia from Indonesia. There's no evidence Indonesia was about to invade anyway. It's ludicrous. But that mindset is kind of there. And that then morphed into China maybe invading, which then morphed into maybe Muslim refugees. Now, obviously, this is about Islam. We all know that. The majority of people who are being detained are Muslim. Not all, but most. And the outsourcing of it and the conditions within the centres run by private companies, as we see here in the UK as well, Serco, G4S and others, Transfield, which is an Australian company, are awful. And I've spent some time in some of these camps, and what you really hear is people's desperation. You hear people absolutely often incarcerated for years. So the sad thing is, and I'll finish on this point, that the European Union, who, as I said before, are utterly incapable of dealing with the refugee issue, are reportedly looking in some ways at the Australian model of housing detention camps offshore, somewhere remote, with no media access. You can't get on there as a journalist. Mm-hmm. You can't go there as a citizen. You can't really get access to people. There are journalists who have access to people by phone or email or other kind of, you know, social media, but nothing face-to-face. Mm-hmm. Europe apparently is looking increasingly to that kind of model to establish similar camps in North Africa, mm-hmm. which, apart from the fact that I'm not sure where they're going to go, it's insane, shows that Australia's model of racial discrimination in their refugee policy has too many friends overseas.
All the stuff we've talked about, I mean, it seems a bit unfair to ask you to sum up very quickly in one final question, you know, what can be done type question. Mm. But are you optimistic that anything could change?
Yes and no. And I will give a short answer because this obviously is a difficult question to answer. I think in some ways you can't not go to somewhere like Afghanistan and not be profoundly depressed. I mean, only a fool could go there and not think that. There are individuals and groups, mostly locals, who are trying to, you know, help drug users, trying to give women who often have very few rights shelters if they're abused by their husbands. That gives me hope. There are people doing wonderfully important things. But overall, in a place like that, right now at least, in 2015, the picture for that country is bloody grim. The Taliban are resurgent. The government is corrupt. ISIS are growing in power. The US, which I think is a good thing, by the way, is withdrawing, but leaving a vacuum nonetheless. And that's being filled by the Taliban, essentially, which I think is a pretty grim future for that country. I guess where I do have hope, and the book talks about this, but the film does in more ways in Afghanistan, Haiti and Papua New Guinea, is really listening to locals who are actually doing interesting things. As I said, in Papua New Guinea, we spend time with a local woman who I think has political ambitions. She's like 24, so she has a long way to go. But someone whose family was affected by the civil war about the Bougainville mine issue, who is pushing for agriculture and tourism as a possible future for that country. It's not kind of sexy and doesn't get a lot of press, certainly not in the UK, but is doing something positive, and it's actually has an impact, and she's attracting local interest and some Australian interest as well. In Haiti, talked to a woman who resisted working in an industrial park and getting terrible wages for making cheap clothes for Americans, and has a small little business on the ground making clothes for locals in her slum. Now, that's not on itself going to change the key economic realities for these countries. Of course it won't. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I'm hoping with the book and the film as well is that people, A, become more aware of it, but B, don't feel disempowered. They actually, for example, if they want to help or change a situation, become far more aware of the groups that are actually helping people on the ground in these places. Don't just always go to the obvious NGOs and charities that you may have heard of that probably have the most money to advertise. Again, I'm not saying they're all bad. I'm saying that do a little bit of research. Do a bit of Googling to find out which organizations on the ground are working with people in Haiti, Afghanistan, wherever it may be, Nepal. You'd be surprised how few of them actually do long term. And that to me is a problem. So I have hope, but also I guess I'm realistic that the situation in many places, including here in the UK, I'm optimistic by it. On one level by the election of Jeremy Corbyn or the possibility of that. It's early days and who knows if it's where it's going to go, if anywhere. But I think the fact that he was opposed by pretty much most people in the mainstream media and yet at the same time has views, despite what you'd read in the press, which is incredibly mainstream. Mm-hmm. What Corbyn on many issues, social issues, political issues, war issues, it's framed as far left and crazy, mm-hmm. but actually it's mainstream. Which is why he became the most popular leader in British political history. Let's see if he can last the distance.
So we've been discussing disaster capitalism, making a killing out of catastrophe, by Anthony Lowenstein. So, Anthony, thank you very much for taking the time to tell me about
it. Thanks so much for having me, Neil. It's been great.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89UP and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our relaunched website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.